From 2000, that's the Cuban Boys with Inertia Kicks from their album Eastwood. Welcome back to the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. China kills 20 Indian soldiers at a remote mountain border in the Himalayas, and North Korea blows up a liaison centre with South Korea. That's not very friendly, is it? Just who is sending a signal to who there? And the Lockerbie bombing, we hear from David Pidcock, who worked on Channel 4's Maltese Double Cross film with the filmmaker Alan Frankovich, the famous, I should say, and amazing, probably one of the greatest documentary directors of all time, Alan Frankovich, and explains the bizarre connection between Lockerbie and 9/11. Also, the latest installment of the sordid tale of King George VI and Winston Churchill's alleged collaboration with Hitler's private secretary and leader of the Nazi party, who disappeared at the end of World War II with all the signatories to all the bank accounts. That's Martin Bormann. The prize being these people's share in $1 billion or so US dollars worth of Nazi loot. Well, is this the biggest cover-up of the 20th century? Anyway, I think it is, and I'm trying to uncover it lie by lie this week. Two more layers of the Bormann cover-up stripped away. Author of Aftermath, Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich, Ladislas Farago's publisher. Old school New York Times investigative journalist, former head of the New York Times book publishing arm, that's Thomas Lipscomb. He gives us his long view after 50 years of investigative journalism on whether or not Bormann survived. Plus, Frank Brandenburg's 1990 book called Quest. Interviews with 11 former SS Nazis, the majority confirming Bormann did survive the war, most of the rest blowing their top when the question is asked of them. In the late 1980s, two of these former, or is it current, SS men claimed to have personally met Bormann after the war. One, Medard Klapper, now running a gun shop in Karlsruhe, said he met him as recently as 1982. Also, what were the secret codes Herr Brandenburg reveals to let you into those Fourth Reich plotters' confidence? But Martin, we've got to start with tensions in Asia, both North and South Korea and China, India. Where do you think is the most serious?
Well, obviously potentially more serious in North and South Korea, because because of the potential for a conflict dragging in the US straight away and so on. But of course, very worrying whichever way you look at it. What's going on really, I think, is the US is determined to basically confront China, and underlying all of this, Narendra Modi has been pushing...
Well, hang on, Martin, before you carry on there, because it looks to me as if both in North Korea and in India, it's China that's doing the confronting, not the US.
No, hang on a minute. In North Korea, the Chinese have not been involved directly.
Well, yes, but it's a client state of theirs, isn't it?
No, it's not. They are allied with North Korea, but they find them very difficult to deal with. The North Koreans have actually got rather an independent line.
Is it a bit like the relationship between the US and Israel, say?
Yes, that would be a comparable, although it's not as close as the relationship between the US and Israel. Narendra Modi is pushing. Don't forget that all of this is in Jammu and Kashmir. And in actual fact, there's a question about whether India should be on that border at all. Because if Jammu and Kashmir was independent or part of Pakistan, then the Indians wouldn't be there at all. And Modi is basically trying to provoke the Chinese. I think that's what's going on. And the Chinese are responding to his provocations. Because
Why would Modi want to do that?
Because Modi is reorienting Indian policy away from being neutral between China and the US to having a more pro-US policy. Traditionally, the Congress governments in India took a non-aligned stance, but Modi wants to get into bed with Trump. They get on quite well, and they've got very similar ideas.
Well, they're also both close to Israel, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. So in other words, what India is doing is playing its part in the bait China game, which Trump is using to try and get re-elected. And of course, he may have bitten off more than he can chew. Because isn't it extraordinary that you've got two nuclear armed powers and they actually end up bashing each other with baseball bats and rocks? And you couldn't make it up, could you?
Well, apparently, I saw a picture today, apparently, of some kind of... I mean, you never really know with these military-released pictures whether they're real, but apparently some kind of giant metal spike with loads of other spikes off of it that apparently the Chinese were using to beat the Indian soldiers, where they actually killed 20 of them altogether, allegedly.
Well, and also the Chinese, I think, have admitted that they had casualties as well. And, of course, both sides basically had an unwritten understanding that nobody is to be carrying firearms, which is why they've ended up fighting like a big brawl outside a pub. But, of course, it's potentially dangerous. But, as I say, don't forget Jammu and Kashmir. Modi has basically ended the autonomy of Jammu and Kashmir. And of course, most of the people there aren't very happy about that at all. And of course, if they had their way, then there wouldn't necessarily be an Indian army there to confront the Chinese on this border. So the whole thing is very worrying. And it looks very, you know, the more you look at the world today, the closer it looks to the run up to World War One, where all sorts of conflicts are potentially going to go off, and political leaders all over the place are basically looking to create conflict in order to divert attention from their own failings.
We've had some interesting revelations from John Bolton this week. I suppose that might also be considered to be electioneering. Is Trump right when he says that Bolton has been saying these things about Trump because he was annoyed about being sacked by him?
I think this, I mean, it's hard to know because we can't get in the minds of these people, but Bolton obviously doesn't like being sacked by Trump. And don't forget, Bolton is 100% deep state man, and Trump is regarded by those people as not entirely reliable. So obviously Bolton has timed this book and the revelations in it to try and mess Trump up. I don't think there's much doubt about that. And of course, the things he's saying sound credible, but nevertheless, it doesn't change anything very much. We knew that Trump was a chump, and we didn't need Bolton to tell us.
Well, also, we've heard that Trump is saying he didn't know. I mean, it doesn't give you a great idea of how switched on the president is. He's kind of saying, well, this guy, I hired him in good faith, and it didn't really seem like he knew what he was doing most of the time. And his stance, of course, on Iraq was very much a hawkish one. You know, I suppose Trump has been on the opposite side. It seems to me he's been trying to sort of disengage, knowing that that's what he promised. But we'll say, what do you think about Bolton, Trump and Iraq?
Well, I think Bolton has always been a hawk on Iraq, on Iran, on everything, really. He's 100%, you know, he didn't see a war he didn't like. Trump, it's basically, you know, he went along with the assassination of Soleimani, for example. He's got his own track record for being a provocateur.
Bolton said that the Iraq war was a great idea and it was a great success. So, I mean, surely how can anybody actually say that?
Well, for some people, it has been a great success. The military industrial complex in the US has now got a blank check to get money to do anything it wants. And people die. That's not really an issue for them. And if Iraq gets reduced to rubble, that's not really a problem for them. They've created further problems for Assad and Syria. Israel's enemies have been discomforted. I mean, if you are a warmonger, then Iraq hasn't been a disaster at all. It's just the poor people who live there who've had to pay the price.
And Trump is saying also today that decoupling from China is on the table. Pompeo's has a 7-hour meeting with a Chinese diplomat, and he just comes out saying, well, divisions remain. I mean, is this moving towards having little or no trade, little or no diplomatic relations with China?
Well, the thing is that China and the US are intimately related at the moment through you could envisage in the future that they may drift apart. I mean, I was reading a Chinese person earlier from the government saying, well, we may have to think in terms of building up our own economy rather than selling things to other people, because if we lose the US market, that's going to really undermine what we're trying to do. I mean, the whole idea of the Chinese getting into the US market and the US allowing that to happen was that the trade would lead to a situation where war would be unthinkable. But of course, the it's quite clear that the deep state in the US does not accept an independent China, and they don't accept an independent Russia. And it's nothing to do with the internal political arrangements in those countries. They just don't want to deal with countries which have got independence from their system. And they are, you know, they're going for broke in terms of trying to break both those systems down. But of course, it's not as easy as they think.
Some chap called Doug Bando, who's been writing about the whole geopolitical situation with the Americans and China, is saying that actually Washington is complaining because China is starting to do what we always do. In other words, I suppose he's talking there about, provocations like what's going on in India.
Well, ultimately, if you go around provoking people, like the assassination of Soleimani at the beginning of the year, it's only because the Iranians showed restraint that we didn't go all out war right there and then. And it's only because the Americans showed restraint without trying not to shoot at the tankers which were bringing oil from Iran to Venezuela that we didn't go to war then. But all around the world, there are a number of flashpoints. There's just about to be the annexation of the West Bank by the Israelis in defiance of international law. That could lead to a war. There's all these conflicts around the world which are related to all these big geopolitical struggles, and also to do with the nation, you know, the economy and the banking system being as shot away as it is. This is just about a perfect storm for ongoing conflict.
So I thought a lot of people have been talking about Bill Gates quite rightly as someone who's very, very much involved with vaccines, particularly powerful at the World Health Organization, using his foundation to fund many departments at influential universities around the Western world, which look into vaccines. I think it was Robert F. Kennedy that wrote a really damning article about Gates' involvement with various vaccine trial programs in the developing world, where one by one it's been pointed out that these vaccines have been killing people rather than protecting them from health. But of course, the implication here is that it's okay to do that in countries where poor people or people that don't speak English, don't speak our language, can be guinea pigs, effectively, rather like porting down guinea pigs for Bill Gates and his vaccines. But William Engdahl's pointed out in the last week or so Bill Gates' connection also with the Arctic Doomsday Seed Vault. That's what he calls it. I don't think it's officially called the Doomsday Vault. It's in a place called Svalbard, which is an island near the north of Greenland. It's quite a long way north of Iceland, where he says, against the backdrop of spreading fear about global coronavirus pandemic, an event slipped largely under the radar at a spot so removed from the rest of the world that most are unaware of its existence. The Svalbard Doomsday Seed Vault on Spitsbergen Island, north of the Arctic Circle, just received an additional major shipment of plant variety seeds for its special storage. What makes this entire seed bank enterprise suspicious, at the very least, is the list of financial sponsors behind the global project. So on February the 25th, more than 60,000 new seed varieties were placed in the vault, the largest deposits of seeds since it operated. This brings the total of seed types to over 1 million since the vault was opened in early 2008. The guar beans from Central Asia, corn seeds, sacred to the Cherokee nations, wild flowers from a meadow at Prince Charles's Highgrove home. The vault is the island which is legally part of Norway since a 1925 treaty. But it's the corporate sponsors that bother him, Martin. And he finishes his article with the following paragraph. He says, a virtually inaccessible seed vault under the control of some of the world's foremost advocates of eugenics and population reduction is definitely remarkable. With more than 1 million of the irreplaceable seed heritage of the world locked inside the Svalbard seed vault, could this be a way for GMO agribusiness giants like Bayer, Monsanto or Syngenta to illegally gain access to those seeds in time of global crisis? It sounds far-fetched, yet there are far-fetched goings on in our world. We could say he who controls the world's crop seeds controls the world. So not only is Gates involved in this vaccine program, Martin, not only for COVID-19, but in other ways, and controlling policy on health around the world through the World Health Organization and through his funding. He's also got his finger in the pie when it comes to our future seeds for the world in order to actually grow food. Incredible, really.
It is, and you'd have thought in a rational world, these kinds of things, like having a, you know, collecting all the world's seeds and to make sure that, you know, that you don't lose them, that should be under the control of governments who are basically answerable to the people for what they do with the material. And this whole idea that corporations should be, you know, major funders of all of this. And of course, it's always presented as philanthropy as well. I mean, Bill Gates is a businessman. He's not a philanthropist. He's there to make money. That's what he's about.
And he's a monopolist. He's not just an ordinary businessman. He's a monopolist in the tradition of John D. Rockefeller, you know, who monopolized the oil production. I mean, he did what's called vertical integration, where you own not only the gas stations in the States, petrol stations, but you also own the entire supply chain, the franchises and the concessions to take oil out, to transport the oil. You own the railways that are doing that. You also own the refineries. You own the whole entire system. And then you can just simply change, rack up the price to whatever you feel like that day.
Well, you know, what you do is you make the price which maximizes your profit. You know, that's what monopolists do. But I mean, the corporate power has taken over the West completely, and they want to run everything, and they've been, you know, they have endless ambition, and you know, all of these, you know, they basically want full spectrum dominance of everything. They want to control seeds. They want to control genetic material. They want to control healthcare. I mean, they want military control. They want everything.
Bill Gates' thing is Microsoft. Obviously, the vast majority of computers in the world have got Microsoft as their operating system. And once they've obtained their monopoly, which they virtually have now, what happens is every time you get your new Microsoft, there are only certain other Microsoft products that will work with it. Now, the EU, for a while, was quite good at stopping this monopoly, but it's really completely ineffective now, as it's actually very, very difficult to launch products which work effectively with Microsoft. And I've seen that myself on various occasions. But look, there's another aspect, another thing I'd like to talk about this week, Martin, and that's what's been going on in Seattle. Members of the African American Council were booed, apparently, as they told protesters in Seattle's autonomous zone that they have hijacked the Black Lives Matter movement by pushing other causes like higher taxes for Amazon. So there's just one headline. But this autonomous area in Seattle, they call it Syria in Seattle, that commune defies the U.S. regime. So what do you make of what's going on in Seattle?
Well, you've obviously got quite a lot of noise and more heat than light coming out of this. I mean, it seems to me that the local authorities in Seattle, which is a more liberal Democrat-controlled city, have basically turned a blind eye to the creation of this autonomous zone over six blocks in the city. But I can't, you know, you can see that it's creating antagonism at the other end of the political spectrum. People saying, oh, how are these people allowed to do this, etc. And it's not even clear what's going on, who's in charge of it, whether the police have access at the moment. They don't, but what if somebody's murdered in there? It seems to me, it's in theory, it's classical anarchism. In practice, it's possibly deep state manipulation of everybody concerned.
Okay, so we're going to have a listen now to David Pidcock, who I spoke to a couple of weeks ago. He happened to be involved with the director, Alan Frankovich. And maybe before we hear from David, you can say something about Alan, Martin, because he started off with making a blockbuster documentary series called On Company Business about the Central Intelligence Agency. He was actually born to a Peruvian mining family, and he went to study film in Los Angeles. But probably his most famous documentary series is the Operation Gladio series that he made for the BBC, isn't it?
It is. And the way he worked is he collected material for years and years and years and years and years without using it, so that he could carry on getting interviews with people who were happy to talk to him, even though they weren't quite sure what he was doing. and he was very crafty about that. So there's a three-part documentary that was shown in the Time Shift series in 1993 about Gladio, and of course he actually got interviews with a lot of the,
yeah, it's Time Watch.
Time Watch, sorry, yeah, and he got interviews with a lot of the top people, for example, from Sismi in Italy, basically saying, yes, we did all of these things. We killed all these people. And there it was on BBC. And it's out there, and everybody should watch it, although you can't see the BBC version. You can just see a pirate version, which I think you were responsible for putting up there.
Well, I was partly. I mean, it was actually, I believe, it was recorded in a journalism school down in Falmouth at the time for journalism students, and it was impossible to actually get copies of this from the BBC. In fact, when we were working on the Conspiracy Files programme, as you remember, Martin, the BBC, the I can't remember the guy's name, but Tristan Quinn, maybe.
Yeah.
He tried to get copies for us and couldn't, although he did manage to watch them himself. So apparently they're still there. Of course, we do know that there are individuals. In fact, the guy who was in charge of Newsnight when the Jimmy Savile piece was pulled, he was sacked from Newsnight, but he went on to take over control of the BBC archive. So he's the sort of person that would say, oh, well, this Gladio series is not important anymore. I think we should just wipe the tapes. But they do exist, thankfully, and they are up online now. And so that was well worth watching. But anyway, let's have a listen now to David Pidcock, who worked on this film, which we can discuss a little bit afterwards, called The Maltese Double Cross, about the Lockerbie bombing. So here's David Pidcock now.
My name is David Pidcock. To my Muslim friends, I'm Dawood Musa, David Moses. I converted to Islam in 1975 and became particularly interested in Middle East politics.
And I know, David, that you got quite involved, didn't you, with the Lockerbie attack. Now, this was Pan Am Flight 103, which was a flight from Frankfurt to Detroit via London and New York. So that's what they used to do in those days. Yeah. You know, you wouldn't get just a flight from A to B. You would quite often stop several times on the way. Yeah. And that's what Pan Am Flight 103 did. But there was a bomb on that plane. And when it was flying up into Scotland on its way to New York, there was a massive explosion. And actually, it's probably fair to say that that was the reason why we didn't have Pan Am anymore. Pan Am was gotten rid of because it was associated with Pan Am Flight 103 and Lockerbie. But at the time, this was believed to have been a Libyan terrorist carrying out this. Can you just take us through, you know, you did quite a lot of investigation at the time, and you were with some quite well-known people looking into what really happened at Lockerbie.
Yeah, because the evidence that came out on the Daily Mirror on the morning of 9/11.
Oh, okay, so it came out 13 years after.
Lockerbie, the lost evidence. Daily Mirror, world exclusive. So on the morning of 9/11, 5 a.m., 0500, whatever it was, the Daily Mirror, Lockerbie, the voice of the Mirror, calls for an investigation. Ray Manley was the guard on the perimeter fence at Heathrow. During the port visit, I found that the padlock had been broken off the doors leading to airside. That was Wednesday, 21st of December, 1998. And his handwritten thing is there. But why was he not called to give evidence at the trial?
The official story is that the bomb had been put in Malta, I believe, before the plane had taken off. But what you're saying is that there was also a break-in to Heathrow. So the bomb might have been put on the Lockerbie plane.
It was definitely put on because of the barometric timer. We know all about that. It was not put on in Malta. And the guys in Malta were admitted later that they received $1 million to fake it. So we've got all that. But this is the important thing. Lockerbie, the truth must come out. And Ray Manley was the one who was never called to give evidence. And why would you think that would be strange or unstrange? I would think it was highly, because they didn't want to be undone, because Megrahi was falsely charged because they wanted to blame an Arab. It's always about blaming Arabs.
Okay, so you were involved with the making of a film about Lockerbie too, weren't you? Can you tell us how that happened?
Well, it was Alan Frankovich, and we wanted to make a film, and it was Dr. Swire, whose daughter was killed on the plane. We were very close with him, and he wanted to get to the truth, and he believed that Megrahi was innocent, and the whole thing, the headline from the Express, admitted saying that the chief of police in Lockerbie in Scotland said that the evidence was faked and put on by the FBI, CIA.
Okay, well, look, who is this guy Frankovich, and how did you meet him?
Well, I met him because we were wanting to find out the truth. And then Dr. Swire, who we were very close with, he, of course, was a key player. So we've got all that information we can provide without any problem. But it was shown in the House of Lords. We showed it, and there was
No. First of all, tell us a bit about this film. What does it show?
Well, it's called The Maltese Double Cross, because the guide in Malta who had the clothing store from which the guys were supposed to purchase clothing from, in which they were secreting stuff, they admitted, and it's on record, that they were paid $1 million to lie. So it wasn't put on in Malta, and it wasn't put on in Frankfurt. But what was put on in Frankfurt was the huge bales of cannabis. And that's what they were all trying to get to when they got to Lockerbie. And there were a lot of rabbis there, too.
Where were the rabbis?
They were there in Lockerbie, because there were a lot of Jews on the flight.
Well, I mean, I suppose that's because, you know, they may be wanting to recover bodies and things like that.
That's right, of course. Of course, absolutely.
Can you just give us a few details from the film? Like, for example, you're talking about cannabis there. This was the idea then, when the wreckage was there, to collect this cannabis, that somebody should make sure that that was taken off the site?
It would also actually raise issues as to, you had this backdoor for smuggling drugs into the United States.
Well, I'd be very surprised, actually, if the Americans needed to import cannabis. They grow it themselves.
Well, they do now, but back then they weren't. They were getting it from places like Lebanon and what have you.
Also, another thing is, did you and Frankovich discover any information about people who were told not to go on that plane at all?
Yes. The South African foreign minister was taken off the plane, and other people, the person who took his flight to that seat, we know him too. So they knew what was going to happen, and the bomb was put on in London. But why wasn't Ray Manley called to give evidence? The police who knew who faked the so-called timer that was found in dense foliage, and that person was also in charge of investigating 9/11. And it was the guy who was a former head of the FBI over there, who just was running that thing against Donald Trump. But they were then planting passports in 9/11.
Oh, you mean Mueller?
Robert Mueller, yeah, hear him.
So that's David Pidcock. Martin, quite a lot to get into there. I think briefly it'd be interesting to hear just your one take on Lockerbie. What's the real take home from what really happened there? What was really going on? Because it clearly wasn't, it was used to bash Libya, which has since been destroyed as a country. It's been in an absolutely terrible state. We're now Turkish troops down there, slave markets, that sort of thing, which of course never happened under Gaddafi. What was it actually really about? Do we know?
Well, I think we got to. It's a very complicated story, so we got to start with what we do know and move to what we suspect. What we do know, I think, pretty clearly, it wasn't the Libyans. And if you think about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense. The plane never went anywhere near Malta or Libya. They said that the bomb went on in Malta and was put on on a connecting plane, which then flew to Frankfurt, and then the bomb was taken as a piece of luggage onto the plane at Frankfurt without a passenger. Now, there's all sorts of reasons that wouldn't happen. It's totally implausible. So we can. So in other words, the Libyans were made fall guys for whatever happened. So we get, and Megrahi was innocent, and I think that the Scottish police are pretty much saying as much now, that he should never have been sent to prison, and that's why Alex Salmond basically at one stage let him go home on because they didn't want a retrial, which would have shown that he didn't do it. And of course, if he didn't do it, somebody else did, and that's the important point. Who else did it? Now, what your man there was suggesting is that the bomb went on in London. I'm open to that idea, but it may also have gone on in Beirut, which is where the plane flew before it went to Frankfurt. And, of course, what they were doing, the CIA fund a lot of their activities through drug smuggling, and there was a standard one theory is that there was a standard drugs run from Beirut to New York, and the bomb was put on as if it were a drug shipment. And the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine were able to get the shipment on the plane if they were the guilty party, but just by making it look as if it was the normal CIA drug shipment, which nobody checked. Now, that's one theory. It could be that the Iranians did it because of the shooting down of their airplane. If you remember, the USS Vincennes had shot down an Iranian aircraft with all hands, everybody on board killed. Other people like Susan Lindauer, who used to work for the CIA, saying, well, she thought it was to do with covering up the CIA's drug lines coming from Beirut. Now, in other words, there are various theories.
I'll just say a little bit more about Susan Lindauer, because what she was saying was specifically there had been an investigation into the CIA doing drug running, and the investigative team were on the aircraft heading back to the US. That's what the specific point she made.
Yeah. So, in other words, her guess of what's happened is different from what the gentleman there said. Although, of course, it doesn't mean that the bomb couldn't have gone on in London, because if you want to kill all the people, you can put the bomb on in Beirut or in London. Anyway, the what people have got to realise, and the Maltese Double Cross, I believe the film's still available. People can watch it.
Yes, it is. It's on YouTube.
It was shown on Channel 4 when it was made. I think it's absolutely clear that the Libyans did not do it. And, of course, by framing the Libyans, it follows the goals of the deep state in the West. They want the Libyans to look bad. And then, of course, they were able to bully Gaddafi to basically what the Libyans were told. You're going to have comprehensive sanctions on your country unless you admit to doing this. Even though you haven't done it. And Gaddafi basically ordered Megrahi to say he'd done it so that he could lift the sanctions on his country. And of course, he then tried to get close to the West. And so, look, I'm not trying to cause trouble for you. I want to join the team. And of course, he was encouraged to do that. Tony Blair went out there to see him, etc. But of course, you're a damn fool if you take anything that these people say, as gospel. And of course, the price he paid for that was ultimately to be removed. By operation, what was it called? Southern Mistral, 2012.
So, the other thing to say about this is that this whole operation Lockerbie to smear the Libyans happened in parallel with the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher in 1984, who was fitted up. Basically, the Libyans were fitted up as her killers. Although documentary for Channel 4. Murder in St. James, a two-part documentary by, I think it was Fulcrum Films, a very powerful film.
Really
beyond any shadow of a doubt, including using British military medical ballistics experts, that there's no way that she could possibly have been shot, the angle that the bullet went through her body from the Libyan embassy. In fact, it was from a balcony or a neighbouring part of the square, which had been hired by British and American security services that day.
Yes. And I think people have got to realise that the people running the deep state are that wicked that they will kill a young WPC just starting out in her career to make Libya look bad. That is how wicked they are. And they are still, they haven't changed. They're as wicked as they've always been. And when these atrocities and murders happen, I've just watched a very good Italian dramatization of the of the Piazza Fontana bomb in 1969. Again, Western intelligence services killed 14 people in the bank, and used it as a means of trying to control politics inside Italy. They are ruthless, and they see themselves as in a war to control the world, and they are not to be trusted.
It's also, if you're talking about Italy, it's also probably worth mentioning the revelations about the P2, because really it was a kind of parallel government in Italy, wasn't it? It was a secret government that was actually really running the country, and the government itself had become a kind of theatre, really, for people to watch on the news.
Well, doesn't that describe the world we live in? That is the reality, isn't it? Underneath there is what people call politics, and of course this week we haven't really done any boring mainstream politics, not much, and what we're doing is we're pulling back the curtain and showing what really goes on. What most people think of as political argument is basically a show, and underneath the show is the real government, the real state, pursuing its goals in alliance with various powerful forces. Yeah. And I don't think you certainly couldn't call Britain a democracy as things stand, and nor could you call many other Western countries.
Yeah, the deep state. And actually, this is a constant struggle. It even was with that film that David Pidcock was involved in there, and Alan Frankovich died in mysterious circumstances at Houston Airport in the customs hall. It's definitely a struggle. They couldn't even get this on the television as they had planned to. They had to go and make do showings of the film, literally with a projector in the House of Lords, in the House of Commons, in Parliament, because the broadcasters refused to broadcast it.
Well, it did go out on Channel 4.
It went out on Channel 4 eventually, but, you know, it was a struggle to get that to happen.
Well, the thing is that unless people have seen something on the terrestrial telly, they think it's just conspiracy theory and they don't have to take any notice of it. But if anybody watches, for example, the Frankovich takedown about Gladio on the Time Watch series, but you've got to watch it to realise these people openly say we did all of these things. And the Red Brigade, supposedly, which kidnapped the Aldo Moro, were being run by the intelligence services. They're the ones who kidnapped the prime minister and murdered him because they didn't want him to bring the Italian Communist Party into a coalition government.
Right, so on to our look at the latest instalment in the investigation into the mysterious disappearance of Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, the guy who had the signatures to all the bank accounts. Now, I've just come across this book called Quest. It's by Frank Brandenburg, who was a young man. He was either 18 or 20 years old. Back in the 1980s, he decided that he wanted to find out more about a couple of issues to do with the Second World War. One was the Holocaust, because there are lots of Nazis that had been around during the war that were still alive in the 1980s that said, oh, well, this was just a fairy tale, it never happened. But the other thing he was particularly interested in was discovering the fate of Martin Bormann. And during the book, he goes and speaks to lots and lots of former SS officers and staff, Wilhelm Hottel, Professor German Gressler, Richard Schultz-Cossens, Rudolf Jordan, Arthur Axmann, Dr. Robert Kempner, Heinrich Heim, Hans Müller, Medjard Klapper, Franz Lechner, Hans Bauer, Joachim Tibertius, and Karl Wolff. All of these people worked in senior positions very close to either Bormann or to people who were involved in the Final Solution. And it was quite amazing, really. The reaction, Martin, was almost universal, really. Either these people said, yes, of course, Bormann survived the war if they trusted him and he as a young man, or else they would go absolutely crazy as soon as he asked the question, like, get out of here or no more questions or that sort of thing. So it was obviously a very tetchy topic.
Well, it is. And the kind of things we've just been discussing, the kind of skullduggery of the intelligence services, well, that's because a lot of fascist intelligence personnel and Nazi intelligence personnel, like Reinhard Gehlen, who ends up running the BND in West Germany, were from the Gestapo. And the kind of tricks that they used to get up with, like the burning of the Reichstag, this is just, I mean, this is just a stock in trade for these people.
Well, when he went to see Herr Klapper, Herr Klapper had some interesting things to tell him about Bormann. He said, oh, most definitely he is still around. He talked about the name of an organization that Bormann controlled in the 1980s. It was Mari Borsol, or whatever that means, based in Madrid. Mari from Martin, Bor from Bormann, and Sol, the Spanish word for sun. The purpose, apparently, of the Bormann organization was to ensure the future will be ours, Klapper said earnestly. The financial matters, I'm just quoting from the book now, the financial matters, for instance, and they are considerable, even on a world scale, real estate, manufacturing plants, all kinds of profitable investments and business ventures controlled by our people, the people of Mariborsol, both old and new. Again, he smiled his disconcerting smile. Such as you, Nikvar, not so. So they were trying to recruit Frank Brandenburg as a young Nazi. Now, into this kind of Fourth Reich Nazi movement. Now, he had rather cleverly said that he was a nephew of Martin Bormann, and that's why he was pursuing this and hoping that they wouldn't actually be able to check up. Frank treated it as a rhetorical question, and he didn't say anything, you know, when he tried to recruit him. And he carried on, though, and to guard the papers and documents handed down to us from the Führer and the Third Reich to guide us, Klapper went on, such as the contents of the crates recovered from a concealment in Dresden. The reporters of the popular press have coined the phrase the Fourth Reich. We do not mind. It will be our Reich. The future will be ours. Martin Bormann himself may not live to see the organization that bears his name become triumphant, he finished, but triumphant it will be. Now, this is a former SS officer talking who survived the war and ended up in Karlsruhe, Martin, running one of the big gun shops there.
Well, I mean, people will be familiar with the general idea that there was a follow-on Nazi international from the Frederick Forsyth book and film The Odessa File. But that was treated as if it was fiction, whereas in actual fact, it's true. And of course, the big cheeses in US and British intelligence at the end of the war were perfectly happy to cooperate under the table with former Nazis of all stripes, because they'd got an overwhelming shared enemy in the Soviet Union, and also because they basically, the oligarchy in the West wants to retain power come what may. And in many respects, you know, the Nazi movement was itself a kind of puppet movement in order to prevent a communist takeover in Germany, etc. And the devil of all these things is in the detail, but there's plenty of information out there for those who've got the will to go and look for it. Paul Manning's book on Bormann being an obvious place to start.
Well, before we hear from I suppose I should call him our star guest, Tom Lipscomb, tonight. I mean, he is an investigative journalist in the States of the very highest order for 30 or 40 years, and also ran the publishing arm of the New York Times. He was also very friendly with Ladislas Fraga, who wrote really the first book on this topic, which was called Aftermath, Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich, which Stuart Stephen, ex-Bristol journalist, collaborated on, who was by that time the foreign editor at the Daily Express. And they published this famous headline in 1972, Martin Bormann is alive. But before we hear from that, Martin, I think, you know, just to sort of show how important this is today, I'm just looking at, because nowadays, apparently, if you compare the Israeli state or Zionists to the Nazis, you're supposed to be some sort of really evil person. Actually, Ken Livingstone was thrown out of the Labour Party for doing just that, wasn't he? They accused him of saying that Hitler was a Zionist. He never actually said that. He said that Hitler supported Zionism. I mean, isn't that quite clear that he did?
Well, I mean, I've got a book here, History Today articles, and one of them is about the trip that was made to Palestine, as it then was, by an SS colonel and a leading Zionist figure to scope out the possibility of German Jews all going to Palestine. And a medal was even struck with a Star of David on one side and a swastika on the other. So this is just historical fact. And of course, the Bormann organization when it continued after the war, were quite clear that they were quite keen to have lots of Jewish business people involved, A, to provide cover, and B, because at the end of the day, Bormann's just a gangster. And but what we're talking about here is gangsterism on a huge scale. And in Argentina, the Jewish community was very heavily involved with Bormann's organization.
Well, when I spoke to Thomas Lipscomb, he explained to me that the person that gave Bormann the idea of putting prominent Jews in charge of his Bormann companies came from Alan Dulles, which I found was amazing. Anyway, look, just to quote this Zionism Exposed in the pages of the New York Times. This is a Jonathan Cook article. Former mayor of London, Ken Livingston, has been wandering in the political wilderness since he pointed out the early sympathies between Zionists and Nazis. Although this has been well documented, discussion of it has been taboo. Now someone called Boehm has addressed it in the New York Times. This is I'll put a link up to this on our show page. This is from 2016, this article. The original sin of such alliances may be traced back to 1941. That's what he says anyway. In a letter to high Nazi officials drafted in 1941 by Avraham Stern, known as Yair, leading early Zionist fighter and member of the 1930s paramilitary group the Irgun, later the founder of another such group, the Lehi or Lehi. In the letter, Stern proposes to collaborate with Herr Hitler on solving the Jewish question by achieving a Jewish-free Europe. The solution can be achieved, Stern continues, only through the settlement of these masses, in the home of the Jewish people, Palestine. To that end, he suggests collaborate with the Germans' war efforts and establish a Jewish state on a national and totalitarian basis, which will be bound by treaty with the German Reich. Now, these are interesting words, aren't they, Martin, for somebody like Stern from the Stern gang to be saying. It certainly looks as if there's a pretty high-level deal going on there between the Zionists and the Nazis.
Yes, and of course, they were the ones who blew up the King David Hotel, which killed hundreds of civilian employees of the British occupation authorities. And of course, what they were offering was to stab Monty in the back as long as they got what they wanted, which was an independent Jewish state. And the fact is that the Jabotinskyites on the right wing of Jewish politics, or Israeli politics rather, they modelled themselves on the Mussolini's fascist movement. And the idea that there's that these opposites can't interact is simply wrong.
So let's have a listen now to Thomas Lipscomb, who I spoke to earlier this week. This is the chap who's he was the editor, really, of the Ladislas Varago book, which was called Aftermath, Martin Bormann in the Fourth Reich, published in the 1970s, the first book really to take seriously the fact that Martin Bormann was very active down in South America. And I think once we've heard this, finally, we'll just round up with a look at, you know, why do I keep using the name Winston Churchill and King George VI in connection with the survival and protection of Bormann after the war?
My name is Thomas Lipscomb. I'm a publisher, editor, and writer based in New York. I've run a couple of different publishing companies. I was the editor for people like Agatha Christie, H.R. Haldeman, and William Sapphire, and any number of top best-selling authors. And I ran the New York Times book company called Times Books. So I've worked a lot with top-selling popular fiction and nonfiction. I've also done my own reporting, investigative reporting for New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Chicago Sun-Times, New York Sun, etc. And I'm currently writing a book, actually two books, one on the Rudolf Hess mystery and the other one on the JFK assassination.
We're here to talk to you today about a book called Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich. And this was published by, I believe he's a Hungarian, called Ladislas Varago. What was your involvement with that and who was this guy?
Well, Lotzi, as we called him. Lotzi was a client of a friend of mine named Ivan Obolensky, and he published his book on Patton with Obolensky Books. So Obolensky sent him to see me because he had a new book in mind, and it was an incredibly interesting book. It was on J. Edgar Hoover, who just died. And so I got to watch Ladislaw Farrago dig up extraordinary material on J. Edgar Hoover right under my nose, and we were working on it when he died.
What about this book, though, the Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich? The idea of Fourth Reich, it almost sounds like a thriller rather than, you know, non-fiction book.
Well, Lotzi's a Hungarian, and he's looking, obviously, in his publisher. Being a publisher, I can tell you, we sometimes stretch a headline or a title. Fourth Reich is, I think, overdoing it. Basically, I think what Farrago believed and what I believe is that basically Bormann was not as much a Nazi in his operations in South America as he was one hell of a businessman with all kinds of fingers and all kinds of pies, as well as cooperating with various intelligence agencies.
Yeah, well, that shouldn't surprise us, because the Nazi Party was very, very close to big business, particularly the steel industry, etc., in Nazi Germany, wasn't it? It was actually funded largely through people like Krupps, the steel companies. So if you wanted a kind of nasty kind of business person, a Nazi.
Well, they did what they needed to do to get financed. They did a very good job of raising money from Germans. But if you get the big money to get over the hump after they were in power so they could stay in power, they had to turn the industrialists in Germany into picking up with the party, which they did, as you remember, through the Night of the Long Knives when they killed off the SA, which basically was competing with Hitler to take over the party and, in effect, to take over the German Wehrmacht and the army itself.
Yeah, the SR, I think, for people that don't know, particularly young people, this was a kind of group of street-fighting thugs, effectively, wasn't it?
Well, more than that, they were basically originally organized to take on the communist street-fighting thugs, who were outnumbered them hugely, and they slowly grew until they outnumbered the Red Front, and then they just kept growing. Interestingly enough, the guy who ran them had taken a couple of years off working to get the Bolivian army on its feet. And when I got to Bolivia, I found all kinds of Ernst Röhm memorabilia all over the place.
So anyway, Martin Bormann, what was his role in Nazi Germany? Because he was eventually a wanted war criminal sentenced to death in absentia at the Nuremberg trials. Who was this guy?
Well, Bormann was basically the guy who took Hess's place when Hess flew to England. Hess was the head of the Nazi Party, as well as being deputy Reichsführer. Bormann was not deputy Reichsführer, but he was head of party leader. And his job was to keep the various Gau. Germany was divided up into districts, each with a Gauleiter. And each Gauleiter, of course, was an empire builder on his own, competing with everybody else and keeping all these people from eating each other up and destroying the overall effort of the party, was the job of the party leader. Secondly, under Bormann, Bormann became the guy that you couldn't get to Hitler without going through Bormann. Hess wasn't interested in that role, but Bormann slowly but surely increased his power until he was controlling access to Hitler himself, and at a time which Hitler was getting more and more unstable, Bormann's grasp was very important.
So if he was controlling access to Hitler, then he becomes pretty much his private secretary. The job of the private secretary is quite often to constantly be kind of dictating what Hitler is saying. And that's quite a powerful role, because it gives them some sort of leeway for interpretation. And particularly when orders are being issued, you know, edicts are being issued.
Private secretary is a very British casting. In the States, we'd call him a chief of staff, and basically he's the slot man. Everything comes over his desk. If you want the boss to sign it, you give it to Bormann. If you want the boss to take a look at it and approve it, you try and convince Bormann first, which in England, the private secretary is quite often in that role and in corporations as well as government positions.
So what about surviving the war? Did he survive the war, as Ladislaus Farrago said, do you think? And if so,
as I found, and to my surprise, an amazing investigation by a young German man, I think he was in his teens, got to Karl Wolff, who'd been the head of the SS in charge of Italy. He's a man actually who surrendered the Italian-German troops at the end of World War II before Nazi Germany surrendered. Quite a brilliant man. And Wolff tried to hook this kid up, you know, this is 20, 30 years ago, with Bormann, who was alive and in South America. And Karl Wolff was no idiot. He was one very canny guy. So if Karl Wolff says he's alive and well and operating in South America, I believe Karl Wolff.
But did you actually have any evidence? Because there's lots of people say that Bormann died literally the last few days of World War II in Berlin.
Well, we have to understand what that's all about. I think we've all gotten a little more cynical about our MI5, MI6, the FBI, the CIA. I think we all now understand when it's convenient for reasons of state, they will lie and lie and lie. Bormann's existence was inconvenient for the Federal Republic of Germany. It was certainly inconvenient for them at a time in which they were trying to reunify Germany, and there were many interim steps they had to take. And one of the steps they had to take was basically to make sure that important Nazis, that groups like the Republikaner Party or some of the neo-Nazi organizations couldn't coalesce around. For example, Hess, who was in Spandau prison, kept his distance from the neo-Nazis. But they were very worried that a Hess or a Bormann or anybody else who was alive, who was one of the major Nazis, might create a focus point that could create a competing power to the Free Democrats, the Social Democrats, and the Christian Democrats in the Federal Republic. So in my opinion, all the Germans did was to crank up a solution to a problem they hadn't solved. Where is his body? Okay, in 1972. It didn't persuade many people, except people who believe what a government intelligence agency tells you, when the intelligence agency obviously has an agenda.
Well, look, I mean, maybe the Germans weren't interested in finding Bormann, but surely the British, the Americans, particularly the Israelis, would be interested.
Well, I think Bormann, and Lotzi believe this, that Bormann was operating and trading information with Western intelligence services. It's one reason they didn't bother to go after him.
So if he did end up in South America, as you believe, how would he have got there?
Oh, there's a rat line through Italy. You could get out through, before the end of the war, it was possible to get out through Denmark and the Baltic, Scandinavian access. There are a lot of ways out. And it's been documented by any number of people who are, God knows, no Nazi fans, how various Nazis got out. Some got out with I forget the name of this passport that you give displaced persons. They pretended to be DPs, Nanking passports. Others got out through the Catholic Church. I don't remember if Bormann was titularly Catholic or not, but the Catholic Church, a certain group within the Catholic Church, was busy getting them out through Italy.
So how did Ladislaus Farrago track Bormann down? Did he actually manage to get photographs of him? Or was this just, was he close, but not quite close enough?
No, Lotzi wasn't into photographs. Lotzi was into contacts and working his way through well-connected people. How he would get the information he got was, he didn't discover, the Steele dossier, or he didn't do it through documentary stuff. He did it by basically like a monkey moving from vine to vine. He would move from contact to contact, and he struck gold with a top Argentine intelligence agent. And I think that's where the story really goes.
But you've got to have a photograph, surely, in order to prove the guy's theorem. He's got to come out of a safe house or whatever it is from time to time. And there's that's surely the key bit of evidence that everyone wants, particularly a newspaper man.
Photographs are faked so often. I mean, they faked Oswald's photograph with the rifle for the Warren Commission. They can fake photographs all day long. I think the authenticity of having top intelligence people take you through files and contacts and hard information is a lot better than relying on any photograph.
So did he manage to track him down to a specific place, or did he have a whole series of places in South America, and which countries?
Well, he worked at it for quite a while. I didn't really think he'd ever get anywhere. But you've got to remember how really fine a journalist he was. He was two things, and it gets a little confusing sometimes. He was a Hungarian and hence one of the world's best promoters. But he was also a very fine journalist. People forget that before the Nazis came to power in the 1920s, Farrago was the New York Times correspondent in Berlin right up to the Nuremberg laws in 1936. So he was there for the whole rise of the Nazi Party for the New York Times. There are not a lot of correspondents that spend almost 10 years. So he was highly valued. Then he went on for the AP, and he covered the Ethiopian War and brought out a lot of the horror stories that we now think of as just part of the history. But Lotzi got the information on the poison gas and a lot of the other things that are outrageous about the Ethiopian War. He then, in World War II, he came to the States. He became an American citizen. He worked for Naval Intelligence. We're talking about somebody with extraordinary abilities. He knew intelligence from the inside, as well as how to get information, how to use contacts as a first-rate journalist, and to do so in totalitarian regimes in places where it wasn't easy. So he had, if anybody had the skill set to do what he did, it was Farrago.
So whereabouts in South America was Borman? Was he in one particular spot, or was he on a border? I mean, that's one obvious thing. Is he to run? You can run either way, can't you?
Well, that's an interesting story. I was sent to La Paz, Bolivia in 1968 to try and get the Che Guevara diaries. Che had just been killed. And every top news organization in the world, from Perry Match to the London Times, were all in La Paz trying to get these documents. And I was staying with the CIA station chief who ran a hotel called the Creon Hotel in La Paz, because I figured I'd stay alive a little longer if I stayed in his hotel. This was a nasty business. And there were still guerrillas around who didn't really want Westerners getting their hands on Che's material. One of the things this guy did, his name was Jim Cagles, wonderful guy. He took me to the German club in La Paz, and he proceeded to point out all the Nazis who were there. It was a great club. The food was terrific. And the Germans, who had been a presence in Bolivia for a long time, had Bolivian beer was absolutely superb. They had great beer. And so I got a sense for the milieu. And, you know, one thinks of Paraguay and Argentina as Nazi places to reside. I never thought of Bolivia, but when he showed me the number of people in the room, well, Lotzi finally ran down Borman, who was very, very sick and I think senile, I can't recall, in some nunnery stuck out in the wilds of Bolivia. So there he was. He finally ran him down. He couldn't talk to him. He couldn't get anything out of him. But he got him and proved he was, in my opinion, he proved that Borman had lived and, in fact, got to South America.
Okay, so what was Borman up to over there? Or what had he been up to?
Well, he seems to have played a very strong hand, from what I've learned from my contacts, and not so much from Lotzi. He was basically taking get, he was like a working like an investment banker. He was directing other people's funds, who were German funds that were already overseas. And there are all kinds of arguments about how much the Nazis got out of Germany before they went and where the money went. But I suspect the money was everywhere from Switzerland to the usual places. And Bormann was in a position to make investments. So he proceeded to put Germans together and, in effect, create interlocking directorships and corporate interests that created quite a powerful business empire. And he was having a ball, making a lot of money, staying out of sight, and doing this. So that's not exactly a Fourth Reich.
Well, no, as I was going to say, is in a way, it sounds to me as if, you know, whilst there were people that were great believers in the Nazi ideals, you know, German nationalism, you know, this kind of fake version of German history, with the Teutonic Knights and all this stuff. But for Bormann, it seems that it was really more of a kind of organized crime operation, a front, really, for organized crime.
I think that's a fair comment.
So, was he able to travel, Bormann, before this period, you know, in the 20 years after World War II, to Europe and North America?
I don't know whether he came to North America or not. My guess, they all traveled. Mengele traveled back and forth to Germany. His family was very wealthy. They were the international harvester or great agricultural implements organization. What do you have in England that does that, makes tractors and things? So they were very, very wealthy. And Mengele would go back and forth all kinds of times. Bormann wouldn't probably be going to Germany, but he might go to Switzerland. He might go to other banking centers, might have gone to London. But I think he traveled intelligently. And my guess is he was very skillful at working bureaucracies, and he would get a high sign from somebody saying, come right ahead, we won't bother you, and he'd do it.
Well, Stuart Stephen was the son of Jewish emigre parents. So they came over right at the very start of World War II to Bristol in the UK, mm-hmm. and he worked for a while on our big regional paper, the Western Daily Press. Then he went up to the Daily Express and eventually became foreign editor there. Now, he picked up on Ladislas Farago's story and ran it as a front page lead, didn't he, back in 1972. Yeah. So Bormann's discovery in 72, why was this story so quickly withdrawn? Because as I understand it, Stuart Stephen was ticked off over publishing this.
Well, you could turn the question around. You could say, why did the German intelligence services suddenly find Bormann's body in 1972?
So was that quite quickly after the Daily Express headline?
You bet. They put that fire out as fast as they could.
I mean, were we talking about within days or weeks or what?
I don't remember what the timing is. As they say, you could look it up. But the point being that Farago's investigations were being watched by every intelligence agency in the world. You used to joke about it. He'd say that, I wonder how many people are listening to my phone tonight. And so basically everybody knew what he was doing. And so heading him off at the pass, nobody wanted to do that more than the Germans. And by golly, if they didn't go and find the body right there by the old bridge, right where the witness Axmann said he'd seen it.
Do we know where and when Bormann died?
I don't, and I assumed at the nunnery up there in the mountains in Bolivia. He was pretty far gone.
You know, if the Germans found the body, what evidence did they have that this was really Bormann and that Ladislas and Stuart Stephen had got it all wrong?
Well, they had, as you may remember, they had DNA that they compared with a relative from the body they found, and they also had dental evidence. Intelligence services always have dental evidence. It's the damnedest thing. It's the one thing. They always can find the dental records. Isn't that something? So they found Bormann's dental records. The story I heard in Argentina was that they went to Bormann's tomb and they cut his head off and took it to Germany and left the rest of the body in the tomb. So the head provides the dental evidence and it provides the DNA. Very convenient. Doesn't take a big package.
Well, I understand that it had this skull had red clay on it, which you don't find in Berlin. You only find it in Paraguay, wherever this skull came from. Fascinating, you know, this forensic evidence, which it doesn't actually add up. It does make you wonder whether it's a cover up of some sort. But this guy Bormann, do we know how much wealth he controlled? At the end of the war, he was the holder of the bank accounts, mostly in Switzerland, of much of the wealth that had been looted from the whole of Europe during World War II.
Well, we can sit and imagine, but I don't think anybody's got a fix on it, because the Swiss aren't going to tell anybody, right? So since the Swiss aren't going to tell, people can sit around and count fingers and toes all they want to. We haven't the least idea. And the real question is, there seems to have been a lot of traffic back and forth to South America with submarines. How much gold did they take over on those trips? They weren't all with people on board, because you couldn't possibly leave Nazi Germany until you got the high sign or somebody would put a bullet through your head. So they were transporting something back and forth to Argentina. But I don't think there's any way of knowing. We know you could look at what was missing, because the Nazis did the same thing the Americans did in World War II. We took everybody's gold reserves and put them in Fort Knox. And the Nazis took Austria's, Hungary's, every country they conquered, gold reserves, and put them in the bank. So you can figure out, and this is really would be an interesting book, somebody figuring out what happened to the money. Add it all up, see how much was recovered, a lot was, and how much is missing.
Now, the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, went for Eichmann, didn't they, in the 1960s?
Yeah.
And yet, by looking at Bormann and his role in the edicts that he issued to do with the Final Solution, he was also the sort of person you would imagine that the Mossad would be on the top of their list.
Well, Eichmann was a paper shuffler. I mean, if he wasn't directly involved in the Final Solution, because Hitler wasn't directly involved in the Final Solution. It was basically an SS operation, and he was a paper shuffler in the Reichskanzlerei. And since Hitler wasn't really getting his hands dirty with it, you can certainly say that Bormann was a war criminal, because he was part of a criminal operation. And the Holocaust was an aspect of the criminal operation. But operationally, Mengele was up to his neck in stuff with the Holocaust, and Bormann wasn't. So if I were an Israeli Mossad agent, I had two reasons to go after Eichmann. One is he totally became so arrogant, he used his own name, and everybody knew who he was. And basically, he was easy to snatch. And finally, he'd put the fear of the Lord into everybody else. So he was a terrific catch for them. Bormann wasn't going to be that easy.
It almost sounds like you're saying that Eichmann was a bit of a scapegoat, actually.
Well, I think one wants to make a point. If I were an Israeli, I would want to find the nastiest butcher I could find and make a public example of him to the Palestinians, the Egyptians, the Syrians, the Iranians, etc., that this is what we do if you screw around with us, and good for them.
Yeah, but Thomas, is there really any point in pursuing this story today? And if so, why?
I think there's a point in pursuing any number of stories whereby we find the intelligence agencies and corporations of the world uniting with bad guys while pretending to be virtuous. I don't mind their saying we're all whores and this guy is convenient to us and that's why we didn't pull him in, whatever they want to do. But the fact that they deny it and they have these huge networks all working together is, I think, obscene.
What about the organized crime aspect, though? I mean, surely, if this guy's been able to operate an ex-Nazi, condemned to death, able to operate in organized crime. It does make you wonder the extent of organized crime today and, you know, how on earth we can deal with ordinary organized criminals when somebody so important as this that you would have hoped they would have been pursued just simply wasn't.
Well, he's not an organized criminal. He's a civil criminal, one. And two, he's operating as a corporate white-collar criminal, not running around shooting people up with Uzis. And so he's not the kind of person who draws a lot of attention to his operations.
I wonder just that finally if there's anything you'd like to add.
I just think that basically the reason to chase after these guys till the last dog dies is to expose the degree of complicity with the West, which many of them have had for many, many years. We know about Operation Paperclip and getting Nazi scientists out and the competition between the East and the West to get their scientists and forget whatever they might have done in Germany. But basically, this goes beyond that. These are high state policy exercises, and we need to know a lot more about what has been going on.
Okay, so that's Thomas Lipscomb there. A couple of things probably to say about that, Martin. He talks a lot about Bolivia there. And isn't it interesting how the Bolivian president, even though he won the election, Evo Morales, has been chased out of the country? That's still apparently, you know, you haven't got a democratic president. He's democratically elected, but there's demonstrations in the streets, and the democratically elected president is chased out of the country. The latest story I've seen about that whole episode is March this year, where the United States University Department, which has been looking into Morales is being chased out of Bolivia, is saying that there was no evidence of fraud in the Morales poll. So everything's still hot in Bolivia.
Well, and there's a big, strong Croatian connection as well. The Ustasha, who were the fascists in Croatia, a lot of them ended up in Bolivia. And, of course, Klaus Barbie famously went to Bolivia, and he was the butcher of Lyon. And he basically trained the Bolivian army after Ernst Röhm, because Ernst Röhm went there in the 30s. This is, we're talking about the 1960s. And Bolivia has got a very strong Nazi fascist history, and of course it's all embedded with the CIA to prevent the Bolivians having a country that they can call their own.
Interesting as well that he was apparently hiding in a monastery, or no, apparently a convent or a nunnery, because Martin Bormann's son is Martin Bormann Jr. is his name. He's been facing, in the last few years, he's been facing accusations of sexual assault because he became a priest. So one does wonder if some of the most evil people in the world choose these roles of priests as a kind of cover for their activities.
Well, as I say, I mentioned the Ustasha earlier. They were Catholics. And a lot of them were protected by the Catholic Church at the end of the war, and were given Vatican passports to get them to Latin America, which is largely Catholic. So the current regime in Bolivia has got lots of links with those kind of people.
Well, I await with some enthusiasm, actually, Tom Lipscomb's books coming out on the flight of Rudolf Hess. And also of the JFK assassination, Martin, because I understand he believes that the Chicago Mafia hitman James Files was the one who actually killed John F. Kennedy, which is exactly the sort of thing that we've been. So it's nice to know that we've got a kind of equivalent, even though he's a much more, you know, sort of highbrow guy working for in the past for a big newspaper, Tom Lipscomb. So, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Irish Republican Labour activist, who you just heard there as well, Martin Summers. Download our MP3s, and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. Also, we'll be on YouTube too, on the Public Inquiry channel. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweek, oneword.org www.tomlipscomb.uk. And thank you very much for one of our listeners. I can't remember who it was now, who suggested I track down Tom Lipscomb about 2 months ago, I think. I got a message saying you should chat to this guy, and there you go. There he was. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Loch, well worth a listen. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m. In a text message to me. So far, it just hasn't appeared. We'll be back on FM soon when other shows resume, hopefully on the week of the 20th of June. That's next week. Pat Hart willing, our managing editor. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.